genius. Within the parameter of genius, and everybody knows what genius is, it's that rarity that's anointed to very, very few human beings per generation. And that's as it should be, I suppose. There is another, what we'll call perhaps minutia, above genius. There's a higher form of genius within the arena we call genius. Let me try to elucidate this. Let's take someone like Mozart. And by the way, Mozart has something to do with a Tatum or Frank Sinatra. They're all the same except there's a style and chronological difference. Take Mozart. My premise is that very rarely will a record be broken if it's the same sort of thing as a Mozart or a Ted Williams or a Joe DiMaggio. Let me explain. In the case of Mozart, I think I'm proving this point, because Mozart died in 1791. He was born in 1756, so that goes back a few weeks. The premise is pretty solid. It has remained as such, namely that no one in music has attained the level of the genius that he had. As an example, he could write music before he could read and spell his own name. He started writing at the age of four, writing music at the age of four. At the age of 10, he wrote his first opera. Imagine writing an opera at the age of 10. Here's another example. Take Beethoven, who was not exactly retarded. We all know his name. At age 31, Beethoven had started and then finished during his 32nd year, his first symphony. Now, having finished his first symphony at age 31 plus, consider Mozart. At the same age, namely 31, Mozart had written 35 of his 41 symphonies. Can you imagine that? It's just impossible. Wow. Brahms, a great composer, took between 14 and 20 years to write his first symphony. I'm not saying one is slacker. No one is better than the other. I'm just trying to point out to you the brand of genius that Mozart had. He became a great pianist. He became, of course, an unparalleled composer. I have a portrait of him standing at a table as a youngster being coached by his father, who was a distinguished violin teacher, teaching him how to play the violin. And Leopold, his father, Mozart's father, said that if he had wanted to, Mozart could have become a world-class violinist. Very few people know this, but just to go on and on and on. Now, let's talk about Mozart himself. He wrote many letters, received many letters. There's a book that is about 12 feet thick, dealing with the letters written by Mozart, the letters written to Mozart, the letters written to Mozart's family, the letters written by Mozart's family. And just to give you an idea, let's say as an example of one of his letters. He was asked, and I have no idea who asked the question, how can you write music so quickly and almost with no mistakes and no corrections and editing? And Mozart said something I think is very cryptic, very mysterious. And these are the exact words. The music, it's already there. All it has to do is be written down. Now, I don't believe in the occult. I don't know what it even means. But was he saying, we'll never know, was it one of two answers to that question? Was he saying that he was a medium, simply being put here to write down the music that had already been put there by some other greater power? We have no idea. Or was it simply that genius simply typified the rapidity of his writing? It's just incredible as to how quickly he would write. And sometimes his music was written and still wet in front of the performers about to play a performance. He wrote specifically for a performance at times because he was so filled with ideas that he was late in writing some of his music. But yet the rapidity was there. Take someone like Ted Williams. Again, what I'm saying, the argumentation I'm carrying is the fact that it may very well be that someday it'll be proven that no one could surpass the kind of genius Mozart has. Let's say this. Let's ask the same kind of question. How many think that another batter will come about and bat 406? It doesn't sound really quite feasible, at least in our day. And that goes back a long time. Ted Williams did this, like a half century ago or more. What about Joe DiMaggio, the great Yankee player? 56 games in a row of a hit or more. I mean, what about James Bradley Jr. the other day stopping at the 29th game? So do we have records that will simply stand? No one really knows the answer, and I certainly don't have the right to say that this will never, these things will never be repeated or exceeded. But the case of Mozart goes back before Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, namely 1756 to 1791, and his record still stands. How many wrote music at the age of three? How many have written 46 symphonies by the age of 33? Not too many. Let's go on with the kind of genius that is analogous to an experience I had when I finished my advanced studies in Germany. In Germany, I was stationed at Frankfurt. I had just finished a tour there for the America Hauser in Germany, and I was stationed at the Paulmann Garden, where I practiced for all of my recitals on a Bechstein piano, just a wonderful piano. And I became aware of something that I had forgotten, that in Frankfurt, there were two institutions, one called the Hochschule, which is the high school, and the other was Three Kings Church. Hochschule was very famous simply because, if for no other reason, one of the faculty members in the 19th century was the widow of Robert Schumann, one of the great composers, and arguably she was the most powerful woman musician in the 19th century, Clara Wieck. And so I became enamored of that place, and I decided to go over there and hob around a little bit. At the same time, I decided to visit the Three Kings Church, because I knew that the organist there was a man by the name of Helmut Walscha, W-A-L-C-H-A, in case you want to check in Google. Walscha was one of my heroes when I was in high school, in that he played organ better than almost anybody else around, except for people like E. Power Biggs, but he was one of the two or three top great organists, and was known for his playing of Bach. When I met him, I was transfixed. I never knew that he had been completely blind almost from birth. And he was one of the few organists who knew by memory all of the known organ works of Johann Sebastian Bach. Can you imagine that? After 3 or 4 months, I summoned enough nerve to ask him the question, how do you learn? And he smiled. And he said, first of all, of course, I know Braille. And of course, I knew at the same time that Braille is relatively slow. And how do you learn all of Bach's works within your lifetime by Braille? And I asked, is there any other way that you learn or learned? And he said, yes. And this is where it staggered me. He said, I have my wife sit down and play the compositions I want to learn, and I know it. Huh. It absolutely transfixed me. When I think about it, it transfixes me even today. Now, this kind of retaining power, we hear in various artists, and Art Tatum was one of them. Tatum was an organism. I think of Mozart as an organism. That's why, perhaps, as a kind of medium through which this music passed so quickly, this pulsating organism was also in the figure of an Art Tatum. Namely, he was very little educated. He never got out of high school. He did some learning at the Toledo, where he was born, Toledo, Ohio, School of Music, and learned classical music. He loved classical music. He learned it, of course, by Braille. He could see legally. He was blind in one eye and totally blind in the other, so he could perceive light and shadow. He never really ever saw the piano that you and I see, that he played on all of his life, and gave more to the instrument than anybody we know of, including classical music when we think about it, and I'll explain that at another time. His learning was the same kind of learning. He would listen and remember. He died at an early age. I mean, he was born, what, in 1908 and died in 1956, 47 years old. And I'll give you an example of what I mean, a la Mozart, in just a few minutes before we hear some of the music that comes out of this thing. He learned by listening. He learned by loving. He loved Fats Waller. Fats Waller was one of his champions. Fats Waller was an incredibly gifted pianist who died in his 30s. We'll talk about that another time. But think of Ain't Misbehavin' if you don't remember Fats Waller. What what Tatum did was to learn so quickly and to amass so much knowledge simply by listening and then playing. He started playing at a very early age. He played before he was five on an old piano. The recordings that we have today tell us a lot about Tatum. And one of these days, I will come in with some copies of recordings made by a wire recorder. We talked about it a long time ago. Recorded by a Columbia University musicological student, 1940-41. His name was Lionel, and guess what? His last name was the same as my boss, Newman. Jerry Newman, I'm sorry. And Jerry followed Tatum around upon getting permission from Tatum to go around the bars in Harlem and follow Tatum around and record. I've got a few of the recordings that have never been commercially looked at and reissued. I've got them. Don't tell me why. I won't go into it. Norman Granz, another character in this mystery surrounding Art Tatum, was one of the great jazz impresarios, a gigantic power. As a matter of fact, he was the first great political and financial power involved in and invested in music who believed in integration. He refused to take money, and he had a lot of money, and he made a lot of money from organizations that required only blacks to work and play their instruments separately from whites. He disagreed with that thing. And he was one of the first. Brenny Goodman, we know, was the first great integrator. He brought in whites and blacks together. But Norman Granz, in terms of recording, made sure that integration was a necessary part of what he did. Granz also was very prescient, very powerful. In 1953, he knew, he just felt, in my estimation, we don't have words, but there, I'm not the only one who feels this way, who has an opinion. He knew that Tatum was not long for this world. Tatum was a drinker. He died of uremic poisoning. Alcohol hastened it. And I have a recording of the only vocal done by Tatum, and he was under the weather in this recording done in Reuben Harris's dive in Harlem. We'll hear this another time. He took Tatum aside in 1953 and he said, "Art, I will give you the best piano, I will open up the best recording studio, and I want you to sit down and play all you know." And Tatum was just as happy as a clam. And to make a long story short, Tatum sat down, I believe this was in Los Angeles in 1953, sat down and played, mostly solo, some with groups, but mostly solo. He recorded 71 tunes in 2.5 days. That just gives you the idea of Mozart all over again in a different form. By the way, in listening to Tatum, he has as many as 5 different arrangements of one tune. And you're going to hear one arrangement of 4 that he did on a particular tune. That's one of the things. But all in all, Granz had him record 80 tunes in 3.5 days in 1953. 2.5 years later, Tatum was dead. Now, I have a Tatum, what I call capital T Tatum, capital T project, which I did, which required almost 2 years on my part. I took out of these recordings of Granz, these are top oral recordings. Thank goodness it was done, and thank goodness for Norman Granz, who had the prescience to say, let's get this man on the record in the best possible conditions. What we're going to hear is the best possible way to hear Art Tatum. Now, Tatum recorded while he was under the weather so much of the time, it's hard to believe that he could do this. Now, when you listen to Tatum, listen for 2 things. I have an analogy when I do musicological tests between Tatum and Bach, believe it or not. When we hear Bach, the first thing that generally is thought of is Bach is the great polyphonist. He wrote many, many great pieces out of the Baroque period with multi-melodies, sometimes as many as 6 melodies going out at the same time. We call it polyphonic music. But one of the things that tends to be hidden, and I use them when I do analysis, is the incredible harmonies that this man enclosed. In his 200 chorales, which we use for analysis in musicology, he was so far ahead of his time harmonically that it boggles the imagination. In Tatum, we have the same kind of thing. When we first hear Tatum, of course, we're dazzled by the digital techniques and the incredible patterns that he imaged. But what we must remember at the same time is that Tatum had a vocabulary that the jazz pianists are still catching up with today. And we're going to hear one of those examples in a moment. But I thought I'd bring this up in terms of the analogy. Now, what we're going to hear first will be out of the Tatum project. What I took was Tatum in a particular arrangement out of these Grant's recordings and looked for and found a parallel in the classical field, one out of recordings made over the last 100 years by the great concert artists that are parallel in difficulty. And what you're going to hear is Tatum, then the classical pianist. And that's what I did throughout the entire project. Tatum, then another great pianist, Tatum, then another great pianist. And three CDs have come out of this. It took, as I say, a long time to put it together. You're going to feel a little comfortable when you hear these two pieces played together, one after the other. Primarily because not only did I choose the pieces, but I sought to find pieces that not only matched in technical intensity, but also the same key. For instance, the first two pieces you're going to hear, This Can't Be Love by Tatum, and then a Scarlatti Sonata played by Horowitz, are both in the key of G major. And don't ask me how long it took to do this sort of thing. It took years to get this thing put together. One of the great pianists in the world, Leif Ove Andsnes out of Norway, asked for my Tatum project, which I sent him, which was a great compliment to me. And another one lies in one of the archives in Europe, but we won't go into that now. Let's listen to an example out of the Tatum project. Number one, you're going to hear, and then without interruption, followed by Horowitz. Tatum first doing This Can't Be Love, and then Vladimir Horowitz playing a sonata by Scarlatti, who was a contemporary of Bach. Have fun. Thank you. just heard Vladimir Horowitz, at that time, the world's perhaps the most powerful pianist alive, directly after Tatum. You can hear the parallels in the modality of digital brilliance. And I use the word digital in terms of the word finger. It's not electronic in this case. You know, a statement made by Horowitz sensationalized the community when he said, and it was one of the headlines in the New York Times, "I wish that I could play like Art Tatum." Now, that sounds pretty cryptic. What in the world was he talking about? And for a little while, I tried to figure that one out, because here was the world's reigning pianist using those words, "I wish I could play like Art Tatum." And it seems to me what he was saying, when I figured it out for myself, is that with all of the technique that he had, he could not improvise. He had to play the written note. Tatum had the freedom. He was not playing any written note. He couldn't see them. And he was doing what? Pop, jazz. He was improvising. All of those myriads of notes you heard were patterns of imagery created by his sense of what to do that comes out of the chord. And so he could, in other words, the piece you just heard, if he played it again, it would not be the same. It would be different every time he played it. So Horowitz was really saying, "I wish I could play like Art Tatum. I wish I had the freedom to improvise with all the technique I have." So it's really a kind of powerful statement about what could have been or would have been. By the way, they became friends. And what a strange group together. Can you imagine? We don't know how many times they got together, but we do know that Tatum at least once visited the Horowitz townhouse in Manhattan. Can you imagine these two, the towering classical pianist known all over the world, and Tatum, who I don't think got out of the 10th grade, and yet they had something common. They both had admiration for each other, open admiration. Horowitz said, "I love your octaves, Mr. Tatum," and Tatum said, "I dig your octaves too, man," which I think is rather interesting. That much we know. There have been many apocryphal stories written about this. Don't believe almost anything you read about it, because no one has ever proved it. But we do know, I do know that they do know, they did know each other. And there are about 12 seconds of a piece of music that Tatum did. You're going to hear it later, T for Two, at Horowitz, in his last video, I believe, called The Last Romantic, sits down with a mischievous look on his face. See, this is recorded in his own townhouse. He plays about 12 seconds of his own transcription of T for Two, and it's absolutely terrible. He had no idea of pop music, but it gives you an idea of what he felt about, how he felt about Art Tatum. Now, the second clutch of the two out of the Tatum project will be Tatum doing, and this is where his love of music, classical music, shows up. He takes a classic written in the 19th century by a composer by the name of Jules Massenet. It's called Elegy. I think most of you will know the melodies very well, very, very well known. And listen to what he does with Elegy. There will be a time about 2 minutes and 10 or 12 seconds into the piece that he moves into a stride left hand and becomes almost diabolical. I have never heard Tatum play the way he does there. Horowitz will follow in the same key, by the way. Well, actually, it's a relative minor, but I won't go into that. But it belongs to the same key that the piece that Tatum plays. It's his melodies on the opera Carmen. Have fun. Please have fun. Thank you. that yelling. And the audiences after a Horowitz concert, and by the way, what you just heard was one of the encores that he loved to play. It was like a football game after the concert. So people actually getting up on their seats and pounding on their seats with their feet, men and women. Horowitz was like that. But did you hear the equality between the two in terms of the brilliance in the patterning? You see, it's amazing what this man, what both of these men could do, and you can really understand why they got together. Now, what we're going to hear next is the piece, the particular arrangement of T for Two that absolutely mesmerized Horowitz, and he had to get to know Tatum. And that's where that T for Two showed up in one of the classical videos that I just mentioned. Tatum recorded T for Two four times, but this is the particular one that Horowitz heard. Listen to it. There you have the absolutely same recording that Horowitz heard, which really began the relationship. The final piece you're going to hear is an example of what I mentioned to you before, the all-important part of Tatum that isn't thought about so much because of the overwhelming brilliance he had technically, and that is his harmonic vocabulary. I decided to take Over the Rainbow by Harold Arlen. Of course, we heard it out of the 1939 Wizard of Oz. Tatum made four different recordings, four different arrangements of Over the Rainbow. 1939, the same year the movie went out, 1948, 1953, and 1956. You're going to hear the 1953 recording of Over the Rainbow. Now, listen, obviously, you're going to get the brilliance that you hear all the time in that wonderful finger technique, but listen to the harmonies. Over the Rainbow is a very simple tune. It has just a few chords. But listen carefully to the color of the harmony that attaches itself to the tune. Okay, that's it. I apologize to both Mike for taking so much of a Saturday and to those of
no
you who
problem.
Are listening, but I needed for you to have a sense of direction about what to listen for in especially our Tatum. Thank you for listening.
It was just awesome, Liz. Thank you so much. Really loved it. And we know the audience did too. We can see the Facebook comments.
I'm grateful.
But now we have a problem.
What's that?
How do we follow that up?
I don't know. Oh, actually, you know what? I do know. Something really exciting. Some new noise. It's really exciting.
Well, like the bus is outside?
No, that's not exciting. That's just... are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Is there a dichotomy when you say Jack White and Stevie Wonder?
Well, it depends. What's a dichotomy?
Well, I mean, just in their stylings and the way that they... Oh, what's a dichotomy? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I missed your little joke there.
Yeah. Went right over your head. I saw it go over your head.
Jack White's got a new record out, and he did an extremely cool cover. What else would he do of You Are the Sunshine of My Life? Have you heard this?
I have. It's incredible. And we were talking about this. I was talking to some music people a while ago about this, how after the deaths of David Bowie and Prince, you know, who are the artists now who are quirky enough and eclectic, I mean, the really eclectic artists who change their stripes all the time and can do it without, I mean, you know, they have enough talent to do it. Jack White's one of the only ones right now.
Absolutely. All right, new noise, everybody, for the last set of the morning. Check this out. It's Jack White, brand new, just a single right now. This is Stevie Wonder's You Are the Sunshine of My Life, WMFO.
You want me to give you my soul and my mind, give you this song if you want it to, just don't leave me far behind. has led to you. Tasted the fruit of your vine. Traveled through time to be next to you. Please say that you will be mine. to the past. With your beauty so precious and the season so fast. And hey, no matter how cold the horizon appeared, or how far the first night when I held you near, we're gonna rise from these ashes like a bird of flame. Take my hand, we're gonna go where we can shine. Na 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 na. We struggle, for all we pretend. You know, you know, you know, it don't come down to nothing except love and end. And ours is a road that is strewn with goodbyes. And as it unfolds, as it all, remember, your soul is the one thing you can't compromise. Step out of the shadow, we're gonna go. Midnight, moon falls silver.
It's WMFO, everybody. Mike on the mic, and Mark and Les Hurwitz here. About 3 minutes till the top of the hour, so we're going to work on getting out of here. But first, thank you guys very much. Really appreciate you being here, as always. It was just a great show today.
Thank you. Yeah, it really was. And that segment, that was pretty incredible. People are talking about it on Facebook right now.
I know.
Thanks, Mark.
You've done it again, Les.
You have done it again.
Well, just tell my question their judgment. That's all.
I will tell them
we
that.
We will tell them that. All right, that last short set, everybody, ended with something new, some new noise, if you will, from Jack White's forthcoming CD, Stevie Wonder cover, You Are the Sunshine of My Life. That was brilliant. Speaking of brilliant, there was a band that Chris Robinson has on the side called the New Earth Mud. A couple of years ago, the disc was This Magnificent Distance. It's If You See California. People are loving that. That's a great track for sure. And ended the day beautifully with David Gray from the A Century Ends disc, and that was Shine.
And that goes out to Lisa?
It doesn't go out to Lisa.
It doesn't? Okay.
Does it?
All right.
No, we just decided that it can't.
And I was just telling Mike that, well, David Gray is one of my favorites. Maybe my favorite right now. And if you go on YouTube and see, just search for Shine Live, and there are some live versions of that song that you will not believe.
We'll play that one of these days.
Definitely.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. I'll talk to you in a week at 9 a.m. Really, really appreciate it. Next, coming up, sitting in for something about the women, is Ryan and his beautiful wife, Alicia. Say hi, guys.
Hi, everybody.
See, they do really well. It's going to be awesome. All right, thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you in
a week.
Have
a good weekend, everyone.
We are WMFO in Medford.
Freeform Radio.
yesterday. Care all you wanna, baby. Everybody does, yeah, that's okay. So slide over here and give me a moment. Your moves are so wrong. I've got to let you know. I've got to let you know. You're one of my kind.